Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
That immigrants help restore the soul of the nation. And Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, flanked by the chiefs of the National Guard and Border Patrol, defended the president's plan to deploy guard troops to the border with Mexico. Chertoff praised the president's call for a guest worker program, likening it to damming a river.
We have to have a spillway, and that's a temporary worker program, which allows us to take economic migrants and channel them in a regulated, invisible way so we know who they are, so we can track them, and so we can bleed some of that pressure that the Border Patrol is facing at the border.
But Republicans in Congress and conservatives are criticizing the president for promoting a plan they call window dressing on border security and an amnesty for lawbreakers. Joining us on the line from Washington is Peter Walston, D.C. correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. And Peter, this was a big deal last night, the president's first domestic policy speech from the Oval Office. There was lots of chatter on conservative talk radio prior. Did he accomplish his goal of winning back some of his conservative base?
Well, it looks like he didn't accomplish that, at least with the more conservative elements of that base. You know, the base is a diverse group. There are those who, like President Bush, kind of side with the business community and support a more open immigration policy. And then there's the base that might be represented by folks like Congressman Tom Tancredo and the Minutemen, who want an absolutely restricted border. President Bush did not win back those folks.
Well, and I was pretty surprised listening to conservative talk radio after the speech. I heard one talk show host speak over the speech and mock it. Another said the president was committing political suicide, and I know you wrote about Rush Limbaugh's thoughts going into the speech.
Yeah, Rush Limbaugh is the one, of course, who used the phrase window dressing, referring to the National Guard troops. You know, the two areas, actually, that this president has had great success, especially with the 2004 election, was drawing more Latino voters to the Republican Party, but at the same time, kind of invigorating the traditional white conservative base of the Republican Party. And on this issue, you're really seeing the tension between those two very important elements of the base. And what President Bush tried to do is balance that last night, but the base just isn't going for it.
Well, Peter, I want to ask you about one point and wonder if anything the president might have added fuel to the fire when he spoke of the catch-and-release program that illegal Mexican immigrants were sent back to Mexico, but those who weren't from Mexico, who were from other countries, were released in the U.S. and told to come back for a court date, and of course they mostly didn't. Michael Chertoff says today, no, the catch-and-release program is now catch-and-remove. But the president didn't say that last night, and I'm sure that for many Americans that was the first they had heard that existed at all.
That's right, and it's not clear how that will play. It seems like that will just confuse the situation. In fact, Karl Rove yesterday gave a speech at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute here, where he also discussed the catch and release program, and he read off a litany of statistics about how many people have been caught and from which country, and which countries it's more complicated to catch them from, and where they're placed. And to be honest, it was just very confusing, and I'm not sure what point he was trying to make. Although he said that catch and release program would be changed permanently by the end of the year. It seems like it's an effort to make the case that they're doing something.
Well, Peter, what does happen now? Will the plan be implemented? Does it have to go through congressional approval? What happens?
Well, there does have to be congressional approval for some aspects of it. Certainly, this is going to take a lot of money. The National Guard forces are, of course, directed by states and governors, but the money for this is going to come from the federal government, and Congress will need to approve that. And right now we're hearing, there was another report in our paper this morning, really looking at the logistics of these National Guard troops. You know, they're going to be there in 2-week installments. They will not have been trained. It will be in lieu of some of their traditional basic training. A lot of National Guard advocates and state and local officials see huge problems, potential problems with that.
Peter Walston, D.C. correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and co-author of the forthcoming book, One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. Peter, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
A recent study, financed by the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, is rocking the world of alcohol treatment. The study claims that a combination of prescription drugs and some therapy is highly successful in treating alcoholism. The study, which took place around the country, looked at two anti-alcohol drugs combined with so-called light therapy. The results say that not only are those drugs as effective as Alcoholics Anonymous or intensive psychotherapy in helping alcoholics quit, but they may help them drink moderately, which is a profound and controversial shift in the thinking that recovering alcoholics can never drink again. In a moment, we'll hear from a doctor, a Boston University doctor, who was lead researcher on the study. But first, we're joined in the line by one of the study's participants. His name is Paul. When he was about to turn 40, he knew he was drinking too much, so he stopped for 10 years. But then he took it up again, and he joins us on the line from his cell phone. Paul, hello.
Hi, nice to be here.
And I understand you take this topic seriously. Alcoholism runs in your family. I mean, what was your thinking behind, you know, deciding you needed to get some help?
Well, primarily because both sides of my family have big incidences of alcoholism. My maternal grandfather was homeless as a result of alcoholism, and I had an uncle on the other side of the family who was as well. I knew from a very young age that I did not want to be like that. Surprisingly, I found myself like that.
So what was your feeling when, you know, geez, I'm drinking again?
Well, I realized that having quit for 10 years, I had a different perspective on things and understood, you know, sort of had the lucidity or semi-lucidity that once I started again and saw that I started to sort of lose my grasp on it. Believe me when I tell you, people didn't know it. I knew it.
And we understand one of the things that Alcoholics Anonymous, in fact, instructs is that, you know, the frightening part is when you discover that will alone doesn't help. I mean, just saying that you wanted to stop didn't seem to work.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. I had a great deal of willpower. I did leave it behind for 10 years and quit cigarettes and that sort of stuff so I could prove to myself that I had that ability. But found that the alcohol had had a different type of a hold.
Yeah. What about AA? What about Alcoholics Anonymous?
Well, I'm a firm believer in it, but from the perspective that I also work was working in the field doing stress work, doing critical incident debriefing in my job that I've retired from. I'm a retired police officer. And so I had experience with that and also dealing with alcoholics and drug addicts on my job. First thing that I would always encourage people is to do a 12-step program, and I still do. I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't attend 12-step programs on a regular basis, but I follow the 12 steps.
Right.
I believe in them. So.
Well, so you admitted that you were an alcoholic, and then you got help by entering the Boston University study, studying a couple of drugs, in fact. And until we contacted you through the study, you didn't know whether you had received a placebo or the real thing. Now you know what has happened. What drug did you take, and what is your experience with it?
Well, there were two drugs that that I received. Naltrexone was one, and the other is Campral. And the Campral is the one that I had actually had the real stuff, and the Naltrexone I had a placebo.
So the Campral, what did that do for you?
Well, the program, first off, requires you to not drink for 4 days, and then they allow it's allowed apparently to you know, to some degree. I did not. After the 4 days, I had no real urgings once that happened. Now, whether that was as a result of taking medication and that helped, or whether that was my determination at the time, I'm not really sure.
Well,
I would have bet that it was the medication, because I felt fairly quickly not particularly any desire to drink. And, you know, to this day, I still don't. I don't have any, and I've been off the medication for some time.
Well, Campral is supposed to help in stopping cravings, but I want to ask you, Paul, one of the components, as you well know, of AA, and you say you do some of the steps, is a fierce self-examination, you know, an honest, you know, self-evaluation. And some people would say that, you know, taking a pill that just stops cravings sort of skips over that self-evaluation. So if there are emotional problems, you know, underpinning alcoholism, those are still going to be there, and they're going to eventually override the medication. What do you think about that? That thinking that this just sounds too easy, too good to be true.
Well, it is, and the reality is, this program was coupled up with two forms of cognitive therapy.
This was private therapy. It was more effective for you than AA?
Absolutely. It was private and anonymous. And hearing I'm going to be putting it on the radio, but it was private and anonymous. But it was also insightful. And gently each time we were encouraged, or I was encouraged, to attend AA or attend a multitude of programs.
Well, Paul, can you just tell us, how do you feel overall? I mean, you've said that you've noticed the cravings have cut back. But how has this rippled out in the rest of your well-being?
Well, it's freeing. It's freeing because you don't have that sort of burden or that chain or that... You know, it's a self-imposed thing, naturally, by doing it, but drinking like cigarettes becomes a sort of a, you know, it's a secondary thought in your mind all the time. You know, I might be working, but I'm thinking, what am I going to do this afternoon, or what time, or when? When you're done with it, it's freeing. I go to events where people are drinking, and I don't have any desire, nor do I, or a craving or anything, and I'm not saying that you don't have to be vigilant.
Will you take this medication for the rest of your life, do you think?
Oh, no. I'm not on any medication for it at all. I stopped taking medication at the end of the medication was a one-year program, and I think I got to say this, maybe 3 years ago that I did that, and maybe even a little bit longer.
But that does bring back the question, Paul, you know, do you worry about a relapse?
It probably sounds foolish, but I don't. I don't, and I would tell everybody and anybody that was asking me that same question about themselves, I'd say don't be foolish, because just previous to this, I said you do have to be vigilant. I do pay attention. Mm-hmm. I do, I do look and see, and I do keep it foremost in my mind. I'm aware.
Well, Paul, I really want to thank you so much for speaking with us, and best of luck to you.
My pleasure. Take care.
That's Paul. He was a participant in the largest study to date on alcoholism, and some very controversial thoughts, I'm sure, for people who have been deeply involved in this topic. And that's why we're going to turn now to one of the lead researchers of the study. He's Dr. Dominic Cirollo, a professor of psychiatry at the Boston University School of Medicine. And Dr. Cirollo, what Paul just said, the fact that he could take medication for a year, a few years ago, and you know that flies in the face of the previous thinking about alcoholism, that it took, constant work through programs like AA to be able to stop drinking.
Yes, that's true. However, I think what the medications add is sort of a jump start, so that during this very vulnerable early period of stopping alcohol, the cravings get reduced. And during this period, people then become freed up to learn how to cope. And Paul mentioned other kinds of therapies that were going on with it, medical management and behavioral therapies. And these teach long-term skills to remain abstinent or to reduce drinking to safe levels.
That's Dr. Dominic Cirollo, one of the lead researchers in the largest study to date about treating alcoholism with drugs. We have a lot of questions, such as, does this help every alcoholic? How does it work? He's just said it's sort of like viewing alcoholism much like diabetes, you know, maintaining it with therapy. But another question, are doctors ready to implement this treatment for alcoholics outside of a study? So we'll get some answers after a break. Stay with us. Much more ahead coming up here and now. Drugs and maintenance programs such as either light therapy or group therapy like AA. Earlier we spoke with Paul, who's stopped drinking. He credits one of the medications he took in a recent study with stopping his craving. Well, one of the lead researchers of that study is Dr. Dominic Cirollo. He's a professor of psychiatry at the Boston University School of Medicine. He joins us in the studio. And Dr. Cirollo, two drugs that you looked at in this study, explain them.
Well, the two drugs, one is naltrexone, which has been around for 10 years or so, and the other is acamprosate, or Campral is the trade name. The idea of the original study was to combine these two drugs because we know they work in different mechanisms in the brain. Naltrexone blocks opiate receptors in the brain, and we think that blocks reward. And Campral or a Camprasate works to stabilize the nervous system as people are withdrawing from alcohol.
And, you know, tell us more about why researchers such as yourself feel this study was even needed. I mean, you know, AA, as we said, is a godsend for so many people. But, you know, what percentage of alcoholics does AA reach?
Well, there's no doubt that AA is a godsend, as are other mutual support groups like the SMART Recovery Program. However, it's still a problem. Alcoholism is still a problem. Not everyone recovers. If you take all comers who want to stop alcohol and look at them a year later, only 20 to 30% remain abstinent. So clearly the treatment's not effective entirely for
everyone. Well, we understand even from the General Services Office of AA, there's an estimate that up to 50% of the participants drop out by the third month and up to 88% drop out after 1 year. So Obviously it's not catching everyone. But one of the most controversial findings of yours and other studies about the new pharmaceutical approach to alcoholism is that it may not stop people from drinking entirely. Paul seems to have been able to just stop, but it may help them drink moderately, which may be a better choice for some alcoholics. Now, as you well know, that's just so controversial within at least the AA field. I mean, the thinking there is that you have to stop completely. There's no middle ground. Do you think there's a middle ground?
Yes, I do. I think it is controversial, though. The idea of all the medication trials to date have been to reduce alcohol consumption to safe levels. That being said, if you look at the Camprel studies, and it's, I think, significant that Paul was on Camprel, the Camprel studies seem to support a large number of abstinent patients in the European and Australian studies, although not in the U.S. studies. So the idea is to reduce the amount of drinking, and that promotes better health and better life functioning. And we have data from this study, which we have not published yet, where health does improve over time with reduced drinking.
And as you well know, I mean, there are families of alcoholics listening to this and saying that I just don't believe that. I mean, there are people who, you know, they can't stop at two or three drinks, and when they go on, it's hell for people. I mean, you can probably understand the skepticism about this.
Oh, absolutely. And I wouldn't want to portray these drugs as a panacea. For some people, they really do help decrease drinking by decreasing the craving for alcohol, decreasing the pleasure one gets from alcohol, and they really sort of lose the taste for it. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't work for everyone. Clearly, it doesn't work for everyone, but it works for a large number of patients.
Well, in fact, there are also some side effects in some people.
Yes, all drugs have side effects, and with the naltrexone, headache, nausea, dizziness, and fatigue are the most common ones. With a Camprasate, diarrhea is the most common one.
Are these drugs now available for general use?
These drugs are available for general use, but I think the major impact of this study is to try to change the delivery system. What we want to do is provide two avenues of care. Some people are more comfortable going to their primary care doctor and saying, I have an alcohol problem. And the primary care doctor is probably going to pick it up first, either in liver enzymes or body changes that he or she picks up from alcohol. Now, if we can develop a system where treatment can be integrated into primary care, that is a major public health advance.
Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, it seems as if you are stressing in the study that, and Paul stressed that a major portion of this was the medical management, the so-called light therapy that he received. You've said in writings that I've read that it's sort of how you teach diabetics to manage their disease. So does every doctor know how to implement that light therapy that goes along with the medication?
No, not at all. I think what doctors know is the model. They know the model from diabetes and other medical illnesses that education is a critical part of treatment. Now, what we need to do is aggressively promote this medical management to primary care doctors, train healthcare professionals in it, and be sure it gets implemented and reimbursed appropriately by health insurance companies.
Right. So there's more work to be done in
Lots.
Education.
Yes.
But in the meantime, doctor, just want to ask you, have you seen somebody go through the study who was an alcoholic and come out the other side free of those cravings? And what's that like if you've seen that?
It's very dramatic when someone responds to the medication, and it's rewarding for the therapy team and for the patient and the patient's family. It can make a huge difference in someone's functioning at work, in their family, and their health.
And I think Paul gave us a clue, but how does someone know if they're a candidate? Paul said, I just didn't like how I felt about my drinking.
Well, you know, unfortunately, the other thing that we need to do is find out who responds best to the medications. We have some ideas. We think that people with strong family histories and strong craving respond very well to naltrexone, and Paul did mention his very strong family history. But we think drugs are probably best in that group. There may be some genetic predispositions, and we know that not all alcoholics are the same and have different genetic risk factors. Those are going to be studies that we're analyzing those data as we speak.
Well, that's one answer, but I was wondering, too, how do you know if you're an alcoholic? And I guess Paul gave us the answer. He just didn't like how he was feeling.
Well, yeah, I think you know you're an alcoholic either when you discover it or someone tells you. If someone comes to you and tells you you have a problem with your drinking, you really need to take a look at your own behavior.
Dr. Dominic Cirollo, he's a professor of psychiatry at the Boston University School of Medicine, which just completed a study on drugs that may aid alcoholics. Doctor, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And for more information on the whole national study, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, still to come, why are the Uyghurs in Albania? More ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science Boston, and the National
U.S. Detention Center in Guantanamo Bay, and sent to seek asylum in Albania. How did they wind up there? Well, first, a little background. The men were picked up when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, and they were shipped off to the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. Last year, the U.S. military concluded they presented no terrorist threat. But cleared by the U.S., the men, who are ethnic Uyghurs, are now wanted by China, which suspects them of being part of a separatist group. The Chinese call them terrorists, even though the U.S. no longer does. Sabin Willett is a lawyer in representing two of the Uyghurs. And Sabin, I understand it was kind of a shock to you to realize that your clients were in Albania.
Yes. May 5th at 4:30 in the afternoon, the phone rings, and that was a Friday, following which we were to go to Washington to argue this case on appeal. We were first up in the Court of Appeals Monday morning, the 8th of May. So the phone rings, and the Justice Department tells us that the case is now moot because our clients have been sent to Albania. And I asked him, well, no, where have they been sent really? And he said, Albania. So we had no advance warning and had to jump on an airplane and fly to Albania and try to find them.
Yeah, why are they in Albania? I mean, I guess that leads to the question, the U.S. have been trying to find some place for them to go. U.S. officials say this. Why was it so hard?
Well, it's probably hard because of the same reason that informed all the questions I got from local Albanian reporters when I was there, which were, first, why is the U.S. sending us its terrorists? And you answer the question and say, well, they're actually not terrorists. Everybody agrees.
And then we should say everybody but the Chinese, but, go on. Yeah.
Everybody.
Yeah.
But the Chinese define people who write poems that advocate for freedom from communism as terrorists. Mm-hmm. So by that definition, a lot of us are terrorists. Everyone who applies a definition that would apply in a Western country agrees these are not people who ever engaged or planned any sort of violence or contemplated any sort of anti-American activity of any kind. The military agrees, the government agrees, we all agree. So you explain that to an Albanian reporter, and then he says, well, why didn't the U.S. take them? And that was a question that I got asked by people all over Europe during the last 6 months when the government said it was trying to send them to other countries where they actually have Uyghurs who live there. And there really isn't an answer to that question.
What does the U.S. say?
That there is no answer to that. I mean, the answer is we should take them. This is a problem that we created. And we have loyal expatriate Uyghurs who are, you know, wonderful resident people here in the States and provide a community that these people could easily integrate into. We created this problem. We broke this thing. We should fix it. And instead, we shamefully shipped these guys off to a desperate slum in the worst and poorest country in Europe.
And, of course, the U.S. officials say the reason that they are in Albania is because no other country dared to take them and risk incurring the wrath of China, which says that the Bush administration has violated international laws and is demanding that they get these people back. I guess we have so many questions about this. Sabin, why were they in Afghanistan in the first place?
My clients were in Afghanistan because they were waiting for a visa to come through from Pakistani authorities that would allow them to travel to Turkey, where they had hopes of a job in a leather factory near Istanbul. But the only place you could stay for the six-month period you have to wait for this visa to come through was in a village in Afghanistan. You said at the outset, I mean, you used the word terrorist. We've used it a couple of times, and people have got to get away from this notion that every human being who drew breath in Afghanistan was some kind of terrorist. These people were never terrorists. The U.S. knew it. They knew it in Kandahar in 2002, but they didn't know what else to do with these guys, so they shipped them to Guantanamo to rot, and they would have rotted if there weren't some habeas case that was brought. In fact, there are Uyghurs at Guantanamo today. The only reason these people were freed is that otherwise the Bush administration was going to have to show up in court on Monday morning and explain why it was imprisoning people who have been determined to be noncombatants by its own military.
Well, I guess part of the reason I asked that question is, what are they saying about this, you know, this round-the-world trip that they've taken? They were headed for Turkey from the outreaches of China, and now instead ended up in Guantanamo and Albania.
Well, the clients, who unfortunately are pretty frightened by this tremendous diplomatic fracas that's blown up with China, one of them said to me in English, Sabin, Guantanamo, one country, one problem. Albania, three countries, three problems. They're caught in the middle between the U.S., China, and the weakest and poorest country in Europe, which has given assurances, I'm told, that they won't be pitched over to the Chinese. But who knows what will happen in 6 months when the spotlight isn't on this problem anymore.
And by the way, why would Albania want to take them, given that it's so controversial?
Because Albania is in the complete thrall of the Bush administration. It relies on this country for a vast amount of foreign aid. I don't mean to belittle the Albanians. I don't think they had any choice here. They were this was forced on them by the Bush administration, and I don't think that they particularly wanted it either. But, you know, there's just too much American aid for them to be able to say no.
Boy, in some ways, you couldn't make this story up. And in others, it's profoundly serious. I mean, China says that your clients are members of the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, classified as a terrorist organization by both the U.S. and China, as we said, a separatist movement. Did you get any indication during your talks with these Uyghurs that they are members of that group?
First of all, the Chinese were permitted to come to Guantanamo and interrogate these men years ago. And the Chinese fed to U.S. interrogators all this stuff about an East Turkestan movement, and my guys were interrogated about it. The reason that that movement shows up on the U.S. lists is because the Chinese said it was, that it A, existed, and B, was a terrorist organization. Now, I don't know whether it exists or not, but what I do know is that both I and the U.S. military authorities satisfied themselves that these people were not part of any such organization. The crowning irony of all of this is that all they've ever admired is the U.S., and all they've ever wanted is freedom from communist oppression. And somebody still needs to explain to me why that makes a person an enemy of America.
Well, what happens now to the Uyghurs in Albania? By the way, are there Uyghurs, other Uyghurs in Albania?
As far as I know, there is not a single human being in Albania who is Uyghur or speaks the Uyghur language. What you need to make refugee status and asylum work at a practical level is you need communities. You need a group of people who speak your language, a group of people with whom you can integrate, you can find jobs, things like that. None of that is present in Albania. Even if it were present, you'd have an enormous economic challenge given the state of the economy there. So it's a very desperate situation.
Well, that's Sabin Willett. He is a Boston-based lawyer who is representing two of the five Uyghurs just recently released from Guantanamo Bay and sent to Albania. We'll follow that story. And still to come today, an Iraqi translator and a U.S. Marine team up on Iraqi television. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, the Caribbean island of Cuba is buzzing. The question is Fidel Castro a khaki-clad man of the people, or is he bordering on billionaire status? Forbes magazine has just listed the Cuban dictator as the seventh wealthiest leader in the world, with a fortune of $900 million. That puts him ahead of the Queen of England and just behind Prince Albert of Monaco. El Comandante, though, as Castro is known in Cuba, took to the government airwaves last night and angrily denounced the story, pledging to resign if anything can be proven true. Gary Marks is a correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. He's based in Havana. He joins us on the line. And Gary, what are people saying today?
Oh, it was just a fascinating thing. I mean, essentially people are, you know, they've been talking about this over the last couple of days because Radio Marti, you know, which broadcasts the U.S. government-funded station out of Miami, has really been harping on this issue. So everybody was watching the Comandante last night, and I think for the most part people think that he's clean.
Well, and is it possible that Fidel Castro could have amassed $900 million and, you know, people not know?
Of course it's possible. I mean, there's no public records here. You can't go down to the courthouse to look at a court file. You can't look at a police record. All the government budget is essentially secret. So, of course, it's possible. But the question is whether or not, you know, this is money has been a driving motive for Fidel Castro. And, you know, I think it's more about power than about money.
Well, you know, I guess my word should have been probable. Is it probable that he would have done
right.
this? He certainly doesn't live that lifestyle. And let's go to the Forbes report, because Forbes says, you know, their calculations are more art than science. But what they've done is, you know, put together some of the state-owned companies that Castro has economic control over and added those up.
I don't want to cast aspersions on Forbes, but it's really, they have, to be honest with you, they have no idea what Fidel Castro is worth, whether or not he squired this money out. I mean, nobody really knows for sure. So they can say it, I mean, last year was $500 million. This year they're saying it's $900 million. Nobody really knows. The question is, of course, what do the Cuban people believe? And that's why Fidel Castro went on the air last night for 4.5 hours. It's really about his integrity, and he realizes that, you know, if people believe he's corrupt, well, then this thing's going to end sooner rather than later. So that's why he went on the air last night.
We're talking to Gary Marks, who's in Havana. We got a funky phone line, but this is fascinating, Gary. So tell us, what was that like last night? We understand he pounded the table. He waved the Forbes magazine around.
Well, I guess you could say it was sort of must-see TV for all Cubans. I mean, it began at about 6 o'clock, and Fidel gave a brief introduction and then turned it over to, I think, four government officials who essentially spent the next 4 hours defending the Comandante and saying it was impossible that he could have stolen the money. And then at the end, Fidel sort of spoke for about a half an hour, and that's when he pounded the table. He threw the Forbes magazine on the table. He essentially said it was impossible that he took this money, that he spent his entire life working on behalf of the Cuban people, and if anybody can prove that he even has $1 in a private bank account, well, then he would resign.
Well, of course, it's former Cuban officials who are saying that Castro skimmed profits off of things like the convention center, MediCuba, which sells vaccines and other pharmaceuticals produced in Cuba. These are state-owned companies that he has economic control over, and they're saying he's skimming off the top. He insists that he only earns 900 Cuban pesos a month. That's about $40 a month. Now, you've said that, you know, who knows if he has the 900 million, but it doesn't seem probable. But is it probable that he only gets $40 a month?
Listen, I mean, Fidel lives like any head of state. Yes, he drives around in a chauffeured Mercedes-Benz. There are several houses. There's no denying he lives like any head of state in that sense. The question is not that. The question is whether or not he has skimmed hundreds of millions of dollars over the year and put the money into bank accounts either in his name or somebody else. That's really the issue, and I don't think anybody has proof one way or the other on that.
Right. How are the people, you know, responding? If you could take a poll, what would you say?
People want to believe Fidel Castro. They want to believe him here. After 47 years, they want to believe that what's gone on here has been the right thing.
Well, and Castro also said, look, I'm 79 years old. Why would I squirrel away money? I have no heir, and I'm not going anywhere. I mean, it does seem to make a point. But given his age, what is the sense of how much longer Castro will lead Cuba?
The sense is that as long as Fidel's alive, he's going to be running the country. The question is, how long is he going to be alive? Nobody obviously knows that.
Gary Mark, Chicago Tribune correspondent, speaking to us from Havana, Cuba, where Fidel Castro is angrily denying a report in Forbes magazine that he's the seventh wealthiest leader in the world with $900 million. Gary, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
were not on Tuesday. We did not forget about you. We deliberately postponed our broadcast out of respect for the Sheikh who died. And I personally, on behalf of the American people, want to express my condolences to all the Iraqis.
That's former Marine, 27-year-old Seth Moulton, and his 26-year-old Iraqi interpreter and co-host, Mohammed Fawzi, in a 2003 television program they produced for Iraqi television. The show was called M&M for Moulton and Mohammed. It was produced by the American military and aired in the months following the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The pair would go on to broadcast stories on issues ranging from problems with the power grid to basketball rivalries. Today, Seth is no longer with the Marines. He's living in Marblehead, Massachusetts, while he applies for grad school. And Mohammed Fawzi is earning his master's degree in translation and comparative literature at the State University of New York in Binghamton under a Fulbright scholarship. And they both join us in our studio today to talk more about their time together in Iraq. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Robin.
And Seth, to you, I want to say welcome back because we spoke to you while you were active. And when you started this television show, you were in the first of two deployments to Iraq. You're a platoon commander. You'd just been to the front lines in the assault on Baghdad. This show that you ended up doing, pretty low production.
Absolutely.
And what was the goal?
Well, we really set out just to do some public service announcements and help Iraqis make the transition to the post-war environment. And eventually it developed into a half-hour TV show that we tried to produce three times a week.
Now, Mohammed, put this in context for us as far as your role. How did you even get involved?
When the Americans came to my city, I talked to some soldiers. You know, I thanked them for what they did, you know, helping us to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And they said that my English is good and I could work with them as a translator.
And so I want to reinforce, this is shortly after the invasion. You were welcoming Seth and the Marines.
Of course, definitely. It was like a miracle, you know. I really couldn't believe that someday we will be able to get rid of one of the most horrible dictators in the humankind.
Well, now through TV, you had a chance to comment on that. Hilla is in central Iraq on the river Euphrates. One of your reports focused on the ruins of the ancient city of Babylon. Let's listen.
All right, we came to Babylon today because Mohammed keeps bugging me and saying, we've got to go to Babylon, we've got to go to Babylon and tell the people what's going to happen with their treasured ruins. Right here, we're standing in front of what I think is a terrible disaster. I mean, clearly Saddam just bulldozed all these ruins.
That's Seth commenting on Saddam Hussein at Babylon. But on the other hand, Mohammed, you saw antiquities ruined in Baghdad.
I only cried once during the war when I saw what happened to the museum in Baghdad. That was just, I think that was just a total disaster. I really felt so bad when I saw all those treasures just being, you know, destroyed or stolen. We just came back from Boston Fine Arts Museum, and I saw some of the Babylonian artifacts there, and the Babylonian lion. And honestly, I really felt so happy because those artifacts were safe.
Let's listen to some more of the program.
We have another music montage to remind everybody about how wonderful life in Hilla is right now. We're not trying to say that everything's perfect, but it's a lot better than it is in the other parts of Iraq.
Now, Seth, that would sound to some like propaganda. Did you see it as your job as a Marine to make the U.S. look good?
Well, you know, quite frankly, I think it's honest to say that it started out that way, and that's kind of what our commanders envisioned. But we quickly realized that just like back here in America, we were in a media market. And if we wanted people to watch our show and believe in what we were saying, we had to present the truth. And so we got some complaints initially that we were just kind of only broadcasting the good stories and not talking about the problems in Iraq. And so we deliberately set out to change that and to present a more balanced point of view because ultimately we were competing for viewership.
You did start to tackle some controversial issues. For example, many people wanted to know why food aid was being held up. Here's a clip where you and Mohammed are interviewing an aid worker from the U.S. Agency for International Development.
The people think that there's no any aid from the USA, so we want to know where are things sent by the U.S. government.
We've heard this a lot from the Iraqi people. They've heard a lot about the aid coming in, but don't see any big difference. Although the ration system that's started again after the war is the same baskets, the source of the aid has has changed, and a large portion of that is coming from the U.S. government.
I can just see perhaps some of your bosses saying, we really don't want you pointing out that the aid hasn't come yet. I mean, what kind of conflicts did you run into?
There were conflicts just about every day, and sometimes they were with my commander, sometimes they were with the Iraqi governor who really had a somewhat old regime style of governing in mind. And so Mohammed and I all the time would get hauled into the governor's office and have to answer for why we were putting this negative stuff on TV. And sometimes my battalion commander, you know, was a little bit unsure whose side he was on. There were some times when even our Iraqi translators would come in the morning for work and say, you know, why did you put this stuff on television? Why don't you just tell the good stuff?
The greatest thing in any democratic country is the free media. And we didn't want to help creating a new Ministry of Information.
You wanted it to be separate from the government.
And that was another thing we had to fight, because the Coalition Provisional Authority set up this their own TV station and then tried to take us all over in our little station down in near Babylon.
Theirs was Al-Araqiya.
Al-Araqiya, right. But the irony of it is that they were terrible at producing something that people wanted to watch.
Well, Mohammed, now that you're in the U.S., what do you think of the way the American media covers the war here?
When I first came here, I thought that it would be great if one of the media stations just document the smile on the kids' faces when they got their first school in their village. It would be great to tell the American people that American soldiers, American Marines do a great job to help people to have better life. I saw this. I was part of this.
Seth Moulton, you're out of the military now. We're sitting here listening to Mohammed, and, you know, there's a disconnect between his experience after the invasion in Iraq and, you know, what we see in Baghdad and the sectarian violence, right, and all these other things. And I wonder if you can speak freely now, if you can, if you would say what did the military do wrong, briefly, and what can it still do to capitalize on, you know, these kinds of stories?
We clearly didn't arrive with a good plan, and that was our first mistake. And then I don't think we were ever, and arguably are still not, honest about really how much this is going to take, both in human and political capital. I think that I have never been to a place in Iraq that suffers from too many American troops. So I would argue that that thinking and argue and trying to get substantial withdrawals right now is not the right route. I think that we have not devoted enough resources politically through the State Department and otherwise to help the Iraqi political process along. And I think that Americans need to be given reasonable expectations about how long this is going to take. And I think it's incredibly important that we make it work.
Seth Moulton, a former Marine, he launched a television show while in Iraq in 2003. His interpreter and co-host at the time was Mohammed Fawzi, who is now studying at the State University of New York in Binghamton. And I want to just thank you both for speaking to us.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Robin.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Virginia Prescott, Lynn Menegon, Deborah Becker, and Molly Hamill. Doug Sugertz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer is Kevin Donovan. Our intern, Daniel Estrin. The senior producer of Here Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. George Bush and Tony Blair, the axis of